Okay, and here we are, hour number two. Glad you're along tonight. This is going to be very interesting, as we always try to present to you material that you often won't easily forget. This hour is going to be dedicated to Harry Cooper of SharkHunters.com and his new book, Hitler in Argentina, The Documented Truth of Hitler's Escape from Berlin. This book is a history-shattering and history-correcting effort to try to bring into balance the truth of what really happened during and after World War II, which was a whole hell of a lot different than everyone is being taught by the controlled media and the controlled so-called education system in the government schools in this and other Western countries. We know who is behind it. We know who controls the agenda. We know how the brainwashing is done. And it is especially delightful for me to be able to have gotten to know Harry Cooper and the incredible work he has done in putting this book together, as well as others. His output is extraordinary. There is just, in my view, no logical way to believe the lie that Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun died in the bunker. This can't happen. Didn't happen. There is no evidence to support it. None. Stalin at Potsdam? Which conference was it, Harry, that Stalin was so angry?
That was after Potsdam. At Potsdam,
he went to Yalta. Was it Yalta?
No. It wasn't a conference when he was so angry. This was in July of 1945.
Ah.
When they were at Potsdam, mm-hmm. Truman asked him if Hitler was really dead, and Stalin simply said no. But then in July of 45, he publicly came out angrily and said that the United States and Great Britain were not doing enough to find Adolf Hitler.
Well,
so if the guy's dead and you've got his body, why are you looking for him? So obviously he wasn't dead and they didn't have the body.
We know so much now about this, thanks to Harry and the people who have worked with him and come forward. The key to it all was a secret agent, an intelligence agent, if you will, who was in the bunker. His name, like straight out of Central Casting in Hollywood, his name was Don Angel Alcazar de Velasco. Now, that's a great name for you. And there are pictures of Don Angel in the book here. And his story is remarkable. How did you first come into contact with Don Angel?
There was a member of Shark Hunters, Robert Wilcox, who had written a book. It was entitled Japan's Secret War, in which he talked about how Japan was actually a little further ahead in the atomic research than the United States was. And mm-hmm. he had run across Don Angel. And he put us in contact, and wow, this was 1984 is when Bob Wilcox came out with his book, and 1985 is when we met Don Angel, met through the mail, never met the man face-to-face, even though he had invited me over to talk. Unfortunately, didn't have a heck of a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
Still don't nowadays, thanks to Obama, but that's another whole story.
Yeah, it's going to get worse, too.
Yeah. But we started corresponding. He became a member of Shark Hunters, and not only pictures of him in the book, there are also copies of letters that he and I exchanged.
I'm going to go. I have the book right here, and what page can I go to find his letters? I've been able to thumb through it a little bit. I just got it a couple 3 hours ago. So.
Yeah, I know. I don't know the page numbers off the top of my head, and I don't have, hold on, my assistant is bringing me a book. It's,
you have an assistant,
do
you?
The book.
Uh-huh. Yeah, nice.
Yeah. Toward the back of the book, you'll find a lot of FBI files. You'll find letters from Don Angel. A heck of a lot in the back of the book.
I got them.
Okay, you got them. Okay,
yeah. The following four pages are one of the first letters from Don Angel, and the letter is in Spanish, and then we have 1, 2, 3, 4.
Right behind it should come the translation.
Now the translation. Okay.
Right.
thanks to Norberto Faradez.
Yeah, I think it's pronounced Faradez, but at any rate, yeah. I don't mean to cut you off here, but one of the reasons our book is head and shoulders ahead of any of the other copycat books coming out now. And our book came out, the first printing as a book was 2006, but I ran it as a series in our monthly magazine almost 20 years ago. The reason ours is so much more than anybody else's, Shark Hunters has a huge network. We've got what we call SEIG agents, S-E-I-G, Shark Hunters, Eagle Hunters Intelligence Group. Mm-hmm. Some of them are ordinary people. Some of them are agents. Some of them are retired agents. They're in many, many countries. And that's where so much more of this comes from. You know, one or two guys trying to research it on their own, that's limited. When you've got dozens of people digging this information up in many countries, you just can't beat it. So Norberto Ferrades was a member, and he was very nice and translated all this stuff for us. There, I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, it's fascinating. I'm trying to look at this letter. There, this first one has Perone, Dernitz. This is a cast of characters that Hollywood would be hard-pressed to come up with and duplicate.
Oh, yeah.
But there's an old saying, there's nothing. Truth is always stranger than fiction.
Yeah,
and
that's for sure.
It's a remarkable story. We also spend time in the book talking about New Schwabenland in
right.
the Antarctic. And
yep.
there's a picture here of what looks like a bunch of guys pulling on a rope on a big ship stuck in the ice.
Oh, that yeah. What page are you on there?
236.
Okay. I'm finally catching up with you here. 236 guys pulling on a rope. That's the Admiral Byrd expedition.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I'm no expert on the Byrd expedition, but most people think it was for more than just cartography, because if you're just going to make maps, you don't send
a military task force.
Right. It's a whole battle group.
Yeah, right.
With a submarine, no less.
Yeah, they went down there to fight something.
Right, or to take possession of something.
Mm-hmm.
And on another page, I don't have it right in front of me, but you'll find explorers, German explorers, all bundled up, and they've got what they call an arrow.
Yeah, I saw that. It's
okay,
an arrow
yeah,
it's, sticking right in the ice, straight down.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
In 1939, Brazil pulled their sailors off the island of Trindade, not Trinidad, but Trindade,
mm-hmm.
And the Schwabenland Expeditionary Force came about a week later, took over the island, raised two 80-meter-tall radio towers, and then from there they went on down to Antarctica, and they had two Dornier whale flying boats, and they would launch them, and every day they would fly over the border of what was New Swabia, Neue Schwabenland, and every kilometer they would drop one of these arrows, they call them, which was a stainless steel spike with a flat top and a swastika emblazoned on the top.
Right.
And every 10th kilometer, they would drop a 2-meter-high arrow with a swastika flag on it, all made
out
of
stainless.
You
got pictures of all this in the book, folks.
Right.
Yeah.
And I guess they were claiming territory for Germany, whatever.
Uh-huh.
And that island Trindade plays a very, very big role, because in 1941, when the United States got into the war, and I don't think this is a causal effect, it just happens coincidentally, the Germans left the island of Trindade, the Brazilians came back, and there's a little monument there, All this is on our website, sharkhunters.com. And the Brazilian Navy, their only reason of being there was to raise the flag in the morning and lower the flag at night and show that they own 200 miles of fishing rights around the island. It was not a military bastion or anything like that. Well, then in July of 45, 2 months after the war ended, the Brazilians took their Navy personnel off the island again, and the Germans came back.
Guess who came back? Now, this is after the war ended, okay?
2 months after the war ended.
Yeah. Did the towers remain, Harry, during the entire conflict?
I think they were there for all that time, but then after the Germans finally left, after 47 or 48, I think they came down. Mm-hmm. The remains of one of the buildings is there. It's just a little building, concrete walls, maybe maybe 8 foot by 8 foot, and there's a picture of me standing in front of it.
I've seen it. Well,
there you go.
Yeah.
And it's also on the website. But the reason this was such an important place, it was right on the 30th meridian, right where the ships and submarines, black boats, even a couple of big sailing ships would come down on their way to Argentina, and they would stop there to pick up fresh water and food. This island is loaded with streams and creeks and stuff with beautiful fresh water coming down from the snow melt.
Uh-huh.
And they kept a large herd of pigs and goats and also wild turtles on the island. So any ships coming by, they would just whack a bunch of pigs and goats, and there's your lunch. The pigs and goats were off the island by the time I got there because they were just, I guess the Brazilian Navy figured they were a nuisance. They were underfoot.
Mm-hmm.
And so they removed them, and now they've just got a lot of fresh water there. And the Brazilian Navy, I mean, you have to have the permission and the assistance of the Brazilian Navy to even go to that island. And they were just super. When I asked, I went to Rio de Janeiro. They put me up in the Navy hotel. They drove me around in a Navy staff car and then took me out to the island on one of their ships. And it was really, the Brazilian Navy was just absolutely super with us. And it's rough going.
How far out is it?
I think it's about 1,000 kilometers out from Rio de Janeiro.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is up or down, very steep mountains. The ground is all loose rocks, and you've got sawgrass about knee-high. So it's really tough going. And I ran I didn't know you were supposed to tell the authorities there when you were going off on a trek. And they don't want anybody going alone because it's really rugged.
Hey,
so after that, every time I lit out on an expedition taking photos, there was this young guy walking along with me. And I'm wondering why. And then I find out it's the Navy doctor. I guess they figured when this old man keels over from a heart attack or something, they got the Navy doctor right there to either pronounce me dead or pump me back to life.
Funny. When the Germans were on there, obviously they had to have more than the one small relic that remains. They must have at one point had a barracks or something.
Well, there are barracks there, or shacks, sleeping buildings, whatever you want to call them. There were at the time because the the Brazilian fishermen built a bunch of shacks around the beginning of the last century, and then these were used by the Brazilian Navy at that time, and then when the Germans came, they used the same things. And then sometime after the 1940s, 1950s, they knocked those down, and you can see some of the foundation on my website, and then they built more modern buildings. They've got one building with about 6 or 7 bedrooms in it for visiting people. They've got a barracks building. They've got a hospital, headquarters building, et cetera, and they're all new construction.
Okay. Now, this island played a key role, obviously, during the war, after the war. It's pivotal to the story in a very tangential way, but it is crucial. Now, there's also an aerial picture the base at New Schwabenland. Now,
oh, yes.
Explain that picture with the circle around something that looks very artificial. What is that?
Okay, help me out again. What page are we at again?
221.
221, stand by. I know what it is, but let me look.
It's right above the picture and the arrow, and it's right in the center of the page here.
Yeah, that is their base, the German base at New Schwabenland on Antarctica for the scientific expedition in 1939. That was their docking area, but that was at Antarctica, not on this island.
Yes, I know. Is that, in other words, is that ice that we're looking on the water something
yeah.
that an ice breaker type ship could get through and dock there at that dive? That's a dock somebody built.
It appears to be, yeah.
Huh.
And, well, the water's not frozen all the time.
In
the summer down there, which is opposite of our season, the water's open, as you see at the top of page 220.
So it looks to me like they pushed a lot of earth into the water and made a shape that would accommodate ships docking there. They might have had heavy equipment down there. I don't know, but that's a pretty big thing, it looks like.
That's another topic for us to deal with at another time.
Okay.
Going down to Antarctica, the cost is just incredible. I belong to the Adventurers Club in Chicago, and one mm-hmm. of the guys I used to have dinner with there every so often is Charlie Walgreen, the guy who owns all the
drugstores,
yeah. And for his 90th birthday, he and his buddies wanted to go down and have champagne at the South Pole. So they chartered a C-130, flew down to the South Pole, got out, all had champagne, got pictures taken, and after about, 1 hour, 2 hours, got back on the C-130 and came home, and it cost them $30,000 per man.
Wow.
Just to fly down there to get their glass of champagne. Now, if you go down there with an expeditionary force,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're talking
you
massive
multiply
money.
I'd guess
$250,000.
Right. Okay.
For whatever.
Now, what we're talking about in the book here is the most complete story of what actually happened to Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun. It is an extraordinary story in many ways, and it's not over.
Right.
Let me see if I can find Catalina. I'm always able to open the book and find her little
yeah,
statement.
Catalina Camaro.
Set that up for us, will you? And I'm going to read that. Here it
while
is.
While you're looking for it,
it's
sure.
called The Maid Knew. The
there
Maid
you go.
Knew. All right, what's the deal with this?
Catalina, as a young girl, she went to work for the Eichhorn family, who owned the Hotel Eden in La Falda in Cordova State, which is about 400 miles northwest of Buenos Aires. Now it's kind of a tourist attraction, but back in the 40s and 50s, it was way out in the sticks. I don't think there was an airport out there. There was no rail, and it was just a dusty old road. And so Catalina went to work for the Eichhorn family, and from what we've discovered, they treated her almost like a daughter. And when Hitler came there to visit, I think it was 1949, it's the end of late 40s, Catalina was there, and she waited on them and described him as bald now and had shaved his mustache. And so we knew he was there. Also, we've just come across another bit of information, which we found after the book went to press. One of the workers for a guy named Ante Pavlik met Hitler three different times when he came to speak with Ante Pavlik in Mar del Plata, which is a big tourist area, but it's also where the Navy base, one of the big Navy bases is for the Argentine Navy.
Uh-huh.
Ante Pavlik was the head of the Croatian National Party, and he kept his people fighting even after Germany surrendered. Finally, you know, the ball game was over and he had the had to flee, so he went to Argentina, and he got a job as a bricklayer. And then through a friend of his, he met Juan Perón, and suddenly he owned a big construction company, and he built some of the skyscrapers that are there today. So when Hitler was speaking with Ante Pavlik three different times, this worker was there and met him. So there's no question, you know, with the information. I've lived this for the last yay many years, and put it all into the book. You read the book, unless you've got concrete between your ears, you have to realize he did not pop himself in the bunker.
Okay, and people will say, all right, Harry, all right, okay, we're listening.
Yeah,
why?
You've been out in the sun too long, Cooper.
Why? That's right, 190 miles an hour too many times with a window down. Why would the United States, we have to take a break here, but we'll ask the question now and then come back and answer it. Why would the United States, which obviously kept Hitler's whereabouts secret from Stalin, why would the United States, with all of its resources, the OSS and the other things, allow this to happen? Why wouldn't they go get him? We do know that they went after Eichmann and the Israelis got him and all that.
A couple of small fries.
That's right. Why would they allow Hitler, Mengele, and thousands of other top-ranking Germans, not all rabid, frothing-at-the-mouth Nazis, be allowed to go to Argentina? Now, I have a source who has a friend who is in his 90s now, who was a P-51 pilot in the war in Europe and was retained and kept over after the war ended, along with his squadron pilots, and they were all checked out on DC-4s, long-range, four-engine, Douglas aircraft DC-4s. He told my friend that he flew what was called restricted cargo from Europe to the Canaries and on down to Argentina. He made four trips. He said his fellow pilots made many, many more. And the cargo was human, among other things. So there you go. Hold on a second. We'll come right back with Harry and find out what the deal was that allowed Hitler and Eva Braun to live out their lives in relative peace and tranquility in a minute. Okay, and we're back with Harry Cooper. On the cover of the book, which I'm sure many of you have seen, if you go to sharkhunters.com and just click on books, you'll find the cover. In the center of it, the cover by David Dees, by the way, our artist.
Yeah, he did an excellent job on that
wonderful
book.
Job. Is a picture of the house, the first home that Hitler and Eva Braun lived in Bariloche, before they moved up north for the remaining years of his life. I guess about, when did they move north? They got there in 45.
Yeah, and we believe he lived in 55 because the area around Bariloche was discovered as a
tourist
place, right?
Yeah.
A huge big lake, Lake Nahuelhuapi, which was great for fishing. I've been out on that lake twice. Beautiful, beautiful. And then you're right at the foothills of the Andes, so in the wintertime, you got skiing. And we've seen pictures of Otto Skorzeny skiing there. And Rudel, probably the greatest pilot of all time, one-legged pilot, and he was skiing there too. So why were these guys skiing in the Andes when they could just as easily be skiing in the Bavarian Alps without having to go over there? Well, we know why they were there.
Beautiful home, which is said to be on the market for $40 million now. It's it's off of an inlet on the lake itself.
Right.
Okay, now, the deal. How was it that Hitler and his wife and so many others were allowed to live? Thousands and thousands were allowed to live, and many of them are still there. There's some still alive, not all that many, but certainly their children and grandchildren must number who knows how many, maybe tens of thousands ultimately. I don't know.
Right. I've met some of them. Just as a quick aside, if your listeners would like a free copy of our magazine, they just send us an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net. and say you heard us on the Ren show and you want a free issue of the magazine, and we'll send it right back by email.
That's nice. It's beautiful, beautiful magazine. You'll love it.
It's got a lot of stuff in it.
It's loaded. I don't know how you do
it. Okay, so why,
yeah.
why weren't they... Now, first off, a few of the, like I say, the small fry, like Fridolin Guth and Adolf Eichmann, they were small fry. They didn't have any money to keep themselves safe. They didn't have any valuable commodity for Juan Perón or for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So when people ask, well, why didn't they go after him? I ask them, well, who's they? And they stumble for a minute, and then they say, well, Israel. And I remind them there was no such place as Israel in 1945, 46, 47. And then they say the Mossad. Well, with no Israel, they had no Mossad. And when Israel first became a nation in 1948, they were so small, they were struggling, and they had no way to get after them at that time. Then somebody, some bright-eyed person will say, well, how about the United States? Aha, there's a good question. Now, there's, in my opinion, my theory, and it's a pretty good theory based on a lot of facts. Why didn't the U.S. go after them? Two reasons. One, when I was a young punk in the United States Air Force, I was a thermonuclear weapons specialist. I was in command of six guys loading hydrogen bombs onto B-47. I went through 6 months intensive school. And the first 3, 4, 5 weeks, we saw movies on the American nuclear weapon program.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early days, we were struggling. We were struggling. Japan test fired their first nuclear weapon 1 week before we test fired our first one. And
no, nobody knows that, by the way.
No. And I learned that part from the book I mentioned by Bob Wilcox.
Yeah, and the Germans test fired theirs before that, apparently, a small
right.
one.
They were way ahead of anybody in nuclear development, although we are told they were not. It's nice.
It's also worth noting that there is more than substantial evidence to suggest that the first atomic bomb we dropped on Japan was essentially a German weapon.
Yeah, there's pretty good evidence on that. And that was the stuff that came over on board the submarine U-234, which was a huge, big mine-laying submarine that had been converted to cargo carrying. And the Johnny-come-lately researchers are finding, oh, yeah, the skipper was Heinfeiler, and they know the names on there, too. But I knew all these guys because they were all members of Shark Hunters. And the uh-huh. skipper, Feiler, I spent a whole day in his home talking to him. Of course, they knew nothing, like Sergeant Schultz. I see nothing. I know nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, right around the time Germany surrendered, the United States weapon program took a giant leap forward. We had all sorts of uranium. We had all sorts of technology that we didn't have. And it's really obvious that there was a deal made between Germany and the United States. Here, we'll give you all this stuff and all these people. And I've got a stack of files, literally 4 inches thick, Jeff, of all the scientists that came over to the United States
uh-huh.
in Operation Paperclip. There were tens of thousands of them. And
absolutely
so,
brilliant people, many of them. This is the brain trust of the scientific world.
Exactly.
Exactly what we got. We jumped ahead a decade or two by making a deal. It was that
right.
simple.
Right, and if we hadn't, probably it would have gone to Russia.
Yeah, that's why Stalin was so angry. He
yeah,
knew
he wanted all
he
the
knew
goodies and,
something was going on. Yeah.
Right, so the United States theory, this is my theory, the United States promised not to go after him. And the other side of the coin, too, the Wehrmacht, the German military, was very heavily entrenched in Argentina, and when Bormann came over, he had the keys to all the bank accounts, and suddenly Juan Perón went from being a colonel in 1945 with no money and no land to suddenly in 1947, he was a general, he had a ton of money, and he had all sorts of property. Unless he won the lottery, we know where that came from.
You're kidding
aside. He and Martin Bormann had accounts in their own names.
Mm-hmm.
And so, even if a great power like the United States was back then, if they wanted him, they would have had to have a full-on military invasion. And at that point in time, nobody wanted war anymore. They got Eichmann, the Mossad did, because he was not under anyone's protection. He lived in a crappy little house about 20 feet by 20 feet, and he worked in a factory. His last job was working for Mercedes-Benz, mm-hmm. and he had to ride a bus 3 hours each way to get to work. And so when he got off the bus one evening, half a dozen Mossad agents were waiting for him. They grabbed him, and away he went. He was not under anyone's protection. Right. On the other hand, Mengele, mm-hmm. He was very, very wealthy. And when he came to Buenos Aires, he went into a very nice hotel for only a few days, and a guy named Gerhard Malbrank, who was a very wealthy Argentinian and a good friend of Perón, went and picked him up and took him to live at Malbrank's house. And in one of our earlier programs, we've seen pictures of that. We've got the same pictures in the book. Mengele on Malbrank's front porch holding the family cat.
Amazing, amazing
picture. And right
picture.
Next to that, there's a photo I took of that very same porch 2 months ago, and it hasn't changed except there's no Mengele standing on the porch.
That's a remarkable scene. Hold
so
on,
many
Harry.
Of these guys were well protected because they had.
Well, that was
skills.
The key. They were under the umbrella of protection. We have to take a break. Just a second. We'll come right back with
very
Harry
well.
Cooper. The book is Hitler in Argentina. This ends any doubt. It ends the mystery, and it tells us the truth. Okay, back in a minute. Okay, back with Harry Cooper, and we're talking about the book Hitler in Argentina. You can get it. Just go to sharkhunters.com, look on the left-hand side, click on books, and there you go. This is the most important book in decades because it ends one of the biggest lies of the last century. Puts it to rest, so to sleep. There are all kinds of vignettes of other top general agents, military, civilian types that went to Argentina, what happened to them. It's an extraordinary story. Just amazing. Mengele, considered to be the beast, one of the most inhuman of all so-called doctors ever to walk this planet. What kind of a person was he? And what else do we know about his stay in Argentina?
What kind of person he was, I can't state equivocally. About that, because I haven't studied him that closely. But one thing I have learned over the years, the raving Nazi that hated God and prayed to Hitler and machine gun people in the water, that was just propaganda.
Carefully constructed by a certain group to make sure that the world never stopped hated Germany for what it did to them and others in the war.
It's still going on. Not only, the so-called survivors are dying off, so they don't get a check anymore, but the children and the grandchildren are getting a check, and now we just find out that they're suing the Bundesbahn, the German rail, because they transported all these people to the camps. So it just never ends.
Well, it's just like American... African Americans asking for reparations for their ancestors being enslaved.
Right.
By the way, that same group of people was the group behind the whole slave industry and brought all those Native Africans over here.
Right. So. My family never owned slaves.
No.
So, but anyhow, people like Mengele, like I say, had tremendous protection. There were others that I had not even heard of, but then, my research brought me to them. And three of the top Luftwaffe pilots, which were not being chased by anyone. Werner Baumbach, the great bomber pilot, Adolf Galland, with 102 or 104 kills, was in command of all the jet fighter squadron. And Hans Ulrich Rudel, probably the greatest pilot of any ever, they had to make a separate medal for him. Many won the Knight's Cross with oak leaf, swords, and diamonds, but they made one for him in gold. So these guys came over there, and they rebuilt the whole Argentine Air Force. And Kurt Tank, one of the great aircraft designers, he designed the Focke Wulf FW-190 fighter plane, the one they called the Butcher Bird. He came to Argentina, and he brought along about 50 aeronautical engineers. And when I was down there 2 months ago in January, I met a very nice guy who was in charge of public relations for their Air Force, and he gave me a ton of goodies, books and DVDs, etc. And I was watching one DVD that showed the Argentine Air Force in the late 50s, early 60s, something like that. And the planes are taxiing past the camera, and all of a sudden, there's a Horton flying wing. And what the heck? A Horton flying wing in Argentina? Yeah, the Horton brothers.
They were there too, Yeah.
They came to Argentina as well. And in 1947, 2 years after the war ended, a group of German scientists opened a nuclear research laboratory on an island in the lake down by Bariloche, where Hitler was living. And right across, about this island is like 400 yards off the main shore. And right on the main shore, Perón built his mountain troop training school for his army. Either he was protecting the island, or he was making sure they were working on the island one way or the other. And they allegedly attained the first cold fusion reaction. Now, there's some question whether they did or not, and I haven't dug into it deeply to say yay or nay, but that's, and that island is still there.
Well, the building ruins are still there.
Oh, yeah, I've been on that island.
The lab is basically, you can see it.
That's correct. You can go in it. Well, if you're allowed on the island. And which I was, two different times, 2008, 2009. The buildings are still standing. Everything that's wood is gone. The roofs, the supports that are wood. Either the people took them for their own building or for fires, or the elements got it. But it's all there, and you can see them on my website. Go to previous tours, then click on any of the Argentine tours or the Brazilian tour to see that island. And incidentally, your listeners can order the book direct from us if they want. Just send us an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net or call us at 352-637-2917 and give us their name, address, telephone number, email address if they've got one, and then put it on their Visa or MasterCard. Or if they'd prefer to mail a check, go to the website and click on books, and it's all right there.
Here's a little vignette from the book I talked about earlier. It's entitled The Maid Knew.
Yeah.
And I'll read this and stop and get you to elaborate. We have about 5 minutes left.
Okay.
Catalina Gamarro worked for Walter and Ida Eichhorn. That's E-I-C-H-H-O-R-N, at their Hotel Eden. She was a young woman, was more like a daughter, as you said early, to the family, and she was with them for years. And she knew that Hitler was at the Hotel Eden at one time. In the year 2004, a friend of yours named Abel, A-B-E-L, Basti, B-A-S-T-I, contacted her and made arrangements to come to La Falda to interview her and to look at any documents and any photographs that Catalina had. He told this author, Harry, that Catalina was ready and willing to speak with him openly and to show him what she had. This was going to go into the book that Abel was writing about the Nazis in Argentina. Her cooperation abruptly vanished and she informed Abel that he should not come, and she said that they told her that she could not speak with anybody or show photos, quote, while the lady was still alive. So translate that for us.
Well, in my opinion, that means that Eva Braun was still alive in, 2004, I think that was.
Right.
Which would not be a stretch because she was born 1912, and in 2004 she would have been 92 years old, which is not a stretch at all. My grandfather's sister was 104 when she died. 3 days ago, Reinhard Hardagen, the guy that sank the first ship in American waters, turned 101, so it's not unheard of.
Right.
And as for they, that's originally what was called Die Spinne, which means the spider, by the SS, and it was romanticized in a novel called Odessa. At that time, these were SS officers and personnel helping thousands and thousands get to Argentina and set up their new lives, etc. Now their children and their grandchildren are still, and they're serious about it. It's not like a social club. They're serious about it, protecting the old images. And so there's places there you can't go. There's people you can't visit. I'm sure Eva Braun is probably dead by now. She would be 102, so chances are she's not with us. But that's the way it was back then.
We talked about some of the pilots. We should mention Eric Hartmann, who had the misfortune to be captured by the Soviets,
right,
the communists, and spent, I believe, 10 years in prison.
Yeah. Yeah, he should have flown out when he had the chance, but I don't know what the real reason was, but he said he didn't feel it was right for him to abandon all the ground personnel and get away safely while they were going to go to prison, so he stayed with them to go to prison with them. I'm not sure that's a nice romance story, and maybe it's true.
Yeah.
But who knows? And as you know, I met the grandson of one of these SS guys in 2010. I don't speak Spanish, but I found out that I can get along okay with my German over there. And I was in one little gift shop. I was going to get something for my wife and kids. And the guy didn't speak English, so I started speaking German. He didn't speak German either, but he's yelling, "Momentito, por favor, momentito," and he's on the phone, bang, zoom. 5 minutes, this good-looking young German kid shows up. He's in his 20s, I guess. Tall, blue eyes, blonde hair. His grandfather was a lieutenant general, Generalleutnant, who was an adjutant to Panzermeier in the Panzer Force.
Hmm.
So there's tons of them there. And they lead a decent life. Priebke, who was a member of Shark Hunters, and he died last year at the age of 100. He lived in Bariloche. He was the headmaster at the German school there. He was also the head of the German cultural center. He was there. There were guys that all the SS guys used to get together at this ultra expensive place every year on the 20th of April, which was Hitler's birthday, to have a big shindig. We've got pictures of that in the book. And of course, you have to wonder, why did somebody build this ultra high buck, very nice plush resort hotel in Bariloche, which was 700 miles southwest of Buenos Aires, and nothing around it. And it was built in 1938-39 with German money. And we have a photograph in there also, taken in 1960, of Dwight Eisenhower at that hotel. And you got to wonder, what was he doing there at this out-of-the-way place?
Yeah.
And there may be a Bilderberger connection. I don't know. I didn't dig into it. But Bill and Hillary Clinton were there when Bill was a president.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and thank goodness for the book. Now we have in our hands, if you pick it up and you get a copy, you'll have the keys to the mystery. It's solved. And not a big surprise when you think about the amount of intelligence, scientific wizardry, genius that the U.S. traded off to leave pretty much Hitler and the Germans alone in Argentina. Thanks for being here, Harry. It's always a pleasure. We'll talk to you again next month.
My pleasure.
Okay, be well.
All right, have a great day, Jeff. Thanks for everything.
Thanks. Okay. Harry Cooper, and again, just go to sharkhunters.com. I kid you not, you read this book, and you'll come away with a whole different view of what we have all been brainwashed with all of our lives, that Hitler died in the bunker. He didn't, and it's right here. Okay, we'll be right back after this.